Hi, good afternoon, everybody. Welcome to the Transportation Finance and Policy Division for this Thursday, March 5th. We have three bills on the agenda, and we have a quorum. And our first item of business is to approve the minutes from March 3rd and Thursday, February 27th. Representative Petersburg, I understand you have some changes to propose.
Yeah. Thank you, Mr. Chair. First, I'd like to approve the February 27th minutes as presented to us. That was the ones we had minor changes on last time.
Okay, so let's do that one first. The approval of the Thursday, February 27th minutes. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. All opposed. The motion prevails. And we have some proposals, proposed amendments to Tuesday, March 3rd. Representative Petersburg.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have one, just an addition, which is on the very first page down at the bottom. I believe since we do move for renewing of emotions for carrying laying over, we should include that. So at the very bottom, it should say Chair Hornstein renews his motion to lay over House File 3252. And with that correction, I would move those minutes.
Okay, discussion. All those in favor of the corrected March 3rd minutes signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All opposed, the motion prevails. Thank you, Representative Petersburg. So our first bill on the agenda is House File 3977, Representative Brand. Welcome back to the committee. And welcome to all the people from the Highway 14 corridor.
Thank you.
I'm going to try to get this to slideshow.
You can proceed.
All right. Thank you for...
Oh, actually, before you proceed, I want to move that House File 3977 be referred to the Capital Investment Committee.
Okay.
Now
that's
we're
the motion.
Okay. Thank you very much. Thank you very much, Chair Hornstein, members of the committee. Today I am here talking about Highway 14. Last year you were in Mankato at the field hearing and you talked about Highway 14. That was on March 8th, just to remind everybody, so almost a full calendar year ago. And since we've had two fatalities on Highway 14. Naomi Peterson was killed in a crash with a semi at the intersection with County Road 37 just outside of New Ulm. And that crash rate for that particular intersection is twice the state average. Aaron Lloyd also died about 26 hours later on that Tuesday in a head-on crash between Cortland and Nicollet. And it's also worth reminding, because we were at that field hearing last year, we had Oney Reinhartz in our field hearing talking about the loss of Michael Reinhart, in another head-on collision, and that occurred on April 4th, 2018, near Cortland. And that was a year, again, prior to our Mankato field hearing. Highway 14 is a very dangerous road. There's no doubt about that. If you look at County Road 24 in Cortland itself, it has poor sight lines, heavy volume of semi-truck traffic. There's about 1,000 semis that go on that road every day that leave New Ulm and go points towards their destination with their goods. In New Ulm, we've got Kraft and 3M, both Fortune 500 companies that are doing business that are drawing people from 50 miles around. Not only are they concerned about their goods, they're also concerned about their employees getting there safely. The statewide fatal and serious injury crash rate for County Road 24 in Cortland is, average is 1.14 per year between 2009 and 2018. Over that same period, that one intersection at County Road 24 in Cortland, in Cortland, was 3.04, over almost three times the crash rate. So I'm going to turn it over today to talk about House File 3977. This bill is an important bill for us to move forward on Highway 14. Those last 12 miles between Nicollet and New Ulm. We have found, after exhausted research, a way to fund Highway 14. It's really important that we get this project moving and done this year. We've got bipartisan support. We've got the support of the Senate. The governor supports the bill. He was just in Nicollet, on Friday announcing this. So we really want to move this bill as fast as possible because it requires a grant writing process to the federal government level in order to get this money. We need to move fast so we can get that grant process started now so we can move dirt sooner than later and hopefully prevent some more of these collisions and fatalities from happening in my district. Right now, I'd like to turn it over to Commissioner Margaret Anderson Kelleher to talk a little bit more about the specifics of this bill. She also has a PowerPoint presentation, and without further ado.
Welcome, Commissioner. Please state your name for the record.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Margaret Anderson Kelleher, Commissioner of Transportation. I have a brief PowerPoint to take you through so that members can both understand the program that we would like to access through passage of this legislation, but also the section of highway that we are talking about here today, and also a little bit about the detail of why this special piece of legislation. So we will begin. This first slide actually shows the section between New Ulm and Nicollet that will be upgraded through this process. This will be the final section, New Ulm, all the way to then Rochester, that will have had serious and significant safety improvements over the last 25 years. And last year, members, you all dealt with the section Dodge Center to Rochester that needed a slight change to be able to sell the bond so that we could move forward on that section. So last summer, I was made aware of the federal Build America Bureau and the Transportation Infrastructure Finance and Innovation Act. That act actually came into existence in 1998, so it's been out there for a while, and that's an important piece of this story that it has been there. We have had enabling legislation for the Commissioner of Transportation to select one pilot program or project since 2010 in the session law of 2010. But the issue has been for MnDOT that the interest rate on the regular TIFIA, I'll just call it TIFIA program, has always been at or above our bond rate. So it has not made sense for us to make application to this regular TIFIA program. But in the fall of 2018, the Secretary of Transportation, Elaine Chao, made a change to this program that created a rural initiatives program. And that rural initiatives program is focused on areas outside the metropolitan area. It is outside of an area that has, I believe, a population of 150,000. So the seven-county metro area is not eligible to apply in this program, but the amazing part of it is it has the interest rate that is half the Treasury bond rate. And so, members, yesterday that sat at 0.8%. When I learned of this program and then learned that last fall we had applied, MnDOT had applied for what's called the Build Fund, the Build Grant Program, Highway 14 was in that application process. That is a competitive program. There were hundreds of applications around the country. We did not get a build grant for Highway 14. I felt an obligation to really figure out, could we utilize this TIFIA program? And that is how we came to this point. So the TIFIA Rural Program, as mentioned, is what House File 3977 addresses. And through a lot of discussion with the Department of Management and Budget here at the state of Minnesota, I know they're in the audience today for questions, they believe that we should enact this piece of legislation that really enables that 2010 session law for the commissioner to do one pilot program. And it does some very specific things. It creates a dedicated funding stream for the department to pay back the loan that is non-tax revenue. It is a fee revenue. It's actually from our overweight truck permitting section. And right now, that has performed usually right around $4 million a year. And this sets up the segregated fund away from any federal funds, away from other funds, that allows for the payback, a smooth payback. When we were doing the calculation on this as at the Treasury bond rate that was above 1%, the payback over a long time 35-year payback would be $1.3 million a year. So you can see the fund has much more coverage than it would need to pay back this fund. The other piece of this, it really helps us be able to be very clear that we have the authority to enter into the loan agreement, the application process, the agreement, and to pay the loan back. And so that's another part of the need of this legislation. It also protects the state's bond rating. However, just our bond rating is AAA plus right now, quite outstanding. I think a $37 million loan is small potatoes in what you're all dealing with in terms of other things right now. And then this kind of outlines for you the cost of what's happening here. So the project cost is a little over $92 million as of February 27, 2020. The loan application would be for approximately $36 million, 49% of the construction cost. We have $36 million currently committed, including a commitment from the Nicollet County Board of Commissioners. There is a remaining commitment due on this project of $20.7 million. And so it's a logical question to ask, how will MnDOT fill that gap? We have just applied for an infra grant. The infra grant went in at a $50 million level. It would be unlikely that that full amount would be granted, although we are working with Congressman Hagedorn's office and the two U.S. senators to show support for that grant. We likely will apply again in the build bucket of dollars that's coming up through the Federal Highway Administration as well. And the reason why is that each of them have some different regulations in terms of what or goals that they're trying to match. Recently, I heard the Secretary of Transportation, I met with her, Elaine Chao. She said that BUILD would have a 50% of its funds going to rural projects. So we believe we need to cover every base with this. If for some reason MnDOT were not successful in receiving either of those grants, we will then work with the district office and within the state office to close that $20.7 million gap. Some of you may wonder why this project and not another project in the state that could fit the program. Frankly, right now there is no other rural project as ready to go as this project is. It has been through, it has its construction drawings, it has largely been through its environmental process, it has broad municipal agreement to move forward with the project, and that's what makes it ideal in this sort of setting. What happens after this legislation passes is that MnDOT will submit a letter of intent for the Build America Bureau to review. It then takes, it goes through a credit worthiness process to make sure that we have everything set up to pay this loan back, that we're good for it. And then once that's established, it takes approximately 3 more months to go through the full underwriting process of the loan. And so in total, that's 6 to 9 months. We'd still believe that we could, if this is successful and the legislation passes, we're able to apply in a timely manner, we believe that we can let the project in 2021 and be in the ground in 22, and it would be 2 cycles of construction to finish the project. So I know, Mr. Chair, that it's sort of rare that we talk about a project in such specific ways, but this is needed because of the application to the Build America Bureau for this rural finance loan process through TIFIA.
Thank you very much, Commissioner. Are there questions for Commissioner Anderson Kelleher? Representative Torkelson. I know when you get in position.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I don't know. I really have remarks, not questions. I don't know if this is appropriate time or not.
Absolutely.
First, thank you, Commissioner, for all the work you've done to get us to this point. It's your dedication to this cause is greatly appreciated, and your dedication to the department and transportation as a whole across the state is also greatly appreciated. I'm happy to be the co-author on this bill with Representative Brand as the chief author, this has been a long time coming for many of us that live along and represent parts of Highway 14. But I think it's also really important that we recognize that this is a bit of a perfect storm, that a number of things have come together at this particular time on this particular project to make it feasible to get it funded and get it done. And it's partly because of good planning, and it's partly because of luck, frankly. First, the federal support that is available wouldn't be available if Secretary Chao hadn't changed that interest rate and made sure that it applied favorably to rural Minnesota. That's a great advantage for us. It also wouldn't be possible to do this if we hadn't already done a lot of work on the Highway 14 corridor. If the Corridors of Commerce program, which, Mr. Chair, you were initiated some years ago, hadn't existed, and if we hadn't happened to have that kind of odd negotiation that resulted in Highway 14 being funded from Owatonna to Dodge Center a couple of years ago, we would not be in a position where we could justify funding this section of 14 now. So that's another piece that just kind of happened. We're fortunate, and we're going to take advantage of it, and I'm very pleased about that, but it took a lot of steps and a lot of cooperation from a lot of sources and resources to get here today, and I can't ignore the help from our congressional offices. The Senate and Congressman Hagedorn's office have been very cooperative and will be cooperative, I'm sure, as we move forward. So thanks to everyone, really, and thanks to all the advocates for Highway 14 that have been knocking on my door for the last 13 years. They started knocking before I got elected, frankly, and made it very clear how important this project was to our part of the state. So thank you, everyone, and thank you, Commissioner, especially, and thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you very much, Representative Torkelson. Very appreciated. Others have some comments they want to share at this point? Yes, Representative Petersburg. I want to get the Highway 14 delegation on record here.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For a lot of us that have been on the Transportation Committee for quite a while, Highway 14 has never been lack of identity for need out there, and I've been pushing for it all the time I've been here. And we were able to get this going and to have it finished all the way to New Ulm, which may not be the end of Highway 14 needs, but at least it gets to where the key need is great. And as Representative Torkelson said, this is due to a lot of work. A lot of people prior to me, as well as myself included, who have always worked and tried to maintain the importance of this, not only for the safety factor, but for the economic region of the area as well. And so I just, again, reiterate the thanks to everybody who has put their foot forward and helped and supported and pushed and worked. And that's how politics and how government should work. So thank you.
Thank you, Representative Petersburg. Others?
Mr. Chair, I do have some other testimony.
Yes, we'd like to get to those. And thank you, Commissioner. I want to thank the Commissioner for her, just also echo what Representative Torkelson said. You, your travels to Washington, your dogged pursuit of this, your ability to research every funding source, leaving no stone unturned. I think that's how we got here, through your efforts, and I appreciate it very much.
Well, Mr. Chair and members, I want to say two things. One is a lot of thanks to the team at MnDOT, who, when first asked about this, kind of gave the very good, excellent answer about that interest rate. And then when we found out about the rural program, really went to work to help us piece this all together. I also want to say to all the members, it is important for all of our transportation system to be improved. And I know you all know that. This happens to be a tool that's made available to us right now, and that session law allows us to forward one project to date. I think that having some innovative tools in the toolbox can help us extend our very limited state resources to be able to get more done for the system. And so I want to point out that I know we are here talking about Highway 14. There are safety needs all across the state of Minnesota, and we need to continue to work on this together.
Thank you, Commissioner.
Okay.
Next, I'd like to call up Mayor Al Paler from Cortland.
Mayor, welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record.
Thanks. Al Paler. I am the current mayor of City of Cortland, which is about 700 people in Nicola County. And I appreciate the chair and the members of the committee listening to me today. U.S. Highway 14 is a daily reality. We can't afford, can't avoid in Cortland. We sit about halfway between Nicollet and New Ulm, as seen on the map that you've had. People talk about the volume of the trucks on Highway 14. You know, we look at it as the rumbling through town. So it's quite extensive. I have a lot of people that are, you know, what can you do about things like that? And, you know, we're working on it. And the other major thing, too, because of the road, it is narrow through the city. So a lot of our buildings, our churches, the businesses, it's very close in relativity to those. Some of the concerns, you know, it's common every day we see kids biking. We have a park right on Highway 14, ballpark half a block away, trying to ride their bikes, trying to cross the highway. And believe it or not, it's gotten worse over the years where people are actually passing inside the city limits. I'm not sure what the hurry is, but things have been changing. And the improvements that are in this plan would bring Highway 14 to the north side of the city, which, yes, does take away the traffic from the businesses, but everyone is on board that the safety is just a bigger issue. The interchange would be on the north end. 2017 and 2018, Cortland participated with MnDOT in a task force, and that's where we determined that the bypass was the best for the city of Cortland. And the Highway 24 intersection would no longer be there. It would go straight through to the north. And Representative Brandon talked about the incidents there. And over the years, the traffic on Highway 14, it did help support the main street business. But because it has gotten so busy, it's just too disruptive. It's too hard to get people on and off that road. We did have some people down, busload. A few months ago, and we put them by the intersection at 24, and I think if you stand there, you'd understand, you know, more of what we're talking about, trucks backing up, school buses, you know, it's just dangerous to get onto the highway. Mm-hmm. And another one I'd like to talk about is the Cortland Volunteer Fire Department. They're deeply impacted on this highway with the location that we're at. They've kind of got the stretch from just about to Nicollet. Nicollet does cover some of it, but all the way to New Ulm. And with the accidents that have taken place, including the fatal ones here in January, it's been very difficult for them. We talk on a daily basis after these incidents. They have their debriefing, but it's hard to get firemen, and we do have a young fire department that's starting on, and I'm not sure they've signed up for this when they are first on the scene. I think they're a little surprised at what they've gotten into. Mm-hmm. You know, the road between Nicollet and North Mankato was one of the most dangerous areas. I grew up in the area. I'd always hear about accidents from Nicollet to Mankato. And since it was expanded, we have not had any fatal accidents. So we can prove that this four lane is safe. We can prove that changing it will save lives, it will expand transportation, the current transportation, and it will improve new transportation for the city of New Ulm, Nicollet, and Cortland. So I thank you for your consideration, and let's pass House File 3977. Thanks again for your opportunity to testify.
Thank you very much, Mayor Paler. Next,
have
the order.
I would like to call down Mayor Fred Frelick from Nicollet.
Okay. Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. My name is Fred Freilich. I am currently the mayor of the city of Nicollet. I'm kind of winging it here today because I wasn't 100% sure I was going to be sitting here, but Mayor Paylor covered most everything I would have told you. However, in my community, it affects us really deeply about these accidents. In my personal family alone, I've lost my uncle on Highway 14. My father was involved in a T-bone crash. Both him and the other woman survived, and that was between Nicollet and Cortland also. Our city shares that road. Our school bus is driving that road. Like Al Paylor said here, what's done for us has been wonderful from Nicollet to Mankato. And any improvement you can make over to New Ulm for the rest of my citizens would be greatly appreciated. I don't personally have anything else I could think of right now to say, but it's already been said, and you're going to hear it again from other folks, too. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Mayor Freilich.
Next, I'd like to call up Kevin Ramey from Owatonna.
Welcome.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Kevin Rainey, and I serve as a member of the Owatonna City Council, and I am also Vice President of the Highway 14 Partnership. I'm here today in support of House File 3977 and to emphasize to the committee that this project is a great thing for all of southern Minnesota and for the entire state. While we have been working on Highway 14 expansion for decades, the current version of the Highway 14 partnership formed in 1998. One of the great strengths of the partnership is that it brings together a unified coalition that spans more than 100 miles. Many have worked collectively and selflessly to achieve gradual progress, and we have celebrated progress at every turn, even when it came on a segment far from our own communities. In 2018, when the opportunity arose to finally fund the remaining two-lane portion connecting my city of Owatonna to Rochester in the east, some of the loudest advocates came from places like Mankato, Nicollet, and New Ulm, some who live more than 70 miles away from the project but saw its importance. Together, along with many of the people on this committee, including Representatives Petersburg and Torkelson, we got it done and broke ground last fall. I'm here today to return the favor, because our partners in New Ulm, Cortland, and Nicollet deserve this long overdue project. The families who have lost loved ones deserve it, and the families who are afraid to allow their loved ones on this drive, on this section of road, deserve it. Each gradual improvement on Highway 14 has brought safety and economic opportunity. The particular section that House File 3977 would help improve is a vital route for manufacturing and agricultural business that contribute significantly to the entire state's economy. And these industries and these communities will be hampered until we can ensure safety on the most vital access route. Until this project is finished, you'll often hear us say that Highway 14 between New Ulm and Rochester is the most densely populated stretch of highway in greater Minnesota without a continuous four-lane connection. We know that some of you are probably just as tired of hearing it as we are of having to say it. I've been here many times. Passing Bill 3977 this year is the best opportunity we've ever had to complete this effort. Mr. Peterson, Mr. Torkelson, and other members have lapel pins saying history matters. History matters on Highway 14 as well. The history on Highway 14 is it's a death trap. The history on Highway 14 is that it is a highway that is used to send product throughout the world. Now, we can put a highway, a four-lane road in, and it doesn't mean that the tragedies will end, but it will significantly drop those. It broke my heart this year to see. I was reading text in the morning, and we had an accident. We had a fatality. The next morning, I was checking my Twitter account again, and I saw that again. Well, it's a repeat. No, it wasn't a repeat. Let's do what we can so we don't have any more repeats. This bill needs to stand alone. I don't want to see it get lost in the omnibus bill. This should carry itself. It's strong enough to carry itself. Thank you for your consideration.
Thank you very much, Councilmember Rainey.
Next, I'd like to call up Karen Foreman. She represents both Mankato City Council and also the Highway 14 Partnership.
Good afternoon. My name is Karen Foreman. I serve on the Mankato City Council, and I'm president of the Highway 14 Partnership. Highway 14 Partnership is an organization of counties, cities, chambers of commerce, businesses, and construction companies that are part of our coalition. It covers all the way from New Ulm all the way over to Rochester. Highway 14 actually goes border to border. You know, centuries ago, somebody said southern Minnesota needs a highway that goes all the way across, and we need that. House File 3977 is the final piece in a puzzle. The first construction on Highway 14 to 14 lanes began in 1959. Like, I was born then, but I wasn't very old. Since then, we've done almost 100 miles with the help of this body and with the help of the Minnesota Department of Transportation. Those regional offices, they rock. They get out there, they look at things, they do it, they help get this put together. This project, it's about the safety, and you've heard about that, but it's also about economic development. You know, what we have in southern Minnesota is not a lot of people like you have in the metro, but what we have is we have cows, and we have pigs, and we have chickens, and we have turkeys. And when they're ready to go to market, they move along Highway 14. Mm-hmm. And the cows, you know, they use the corn and the soybeans that we grow. We feed it to them. They make milk. They take that milk to New Ulm. There's a dairy there, and they make butter. And they regularly load a semi-truck, a semi-trailer, floor to top, side to side, front to back, with butter from those cows in Brown County that are there in New Ulm, and they take it all the way to New Jersey. Now, they drive on divided four-lane roads once they get past Nicollet, all the way. And when they turn that truck around and bring it back, all the way. So the first 12 miles and the last 12 miles, they're driving on dangerous roads. So I talked to you about this because economic development is so important. It brings us jobs. Those jobs are going to produce income, and that income tax is going to come up here to the Capitol. They're also going to have sales tax, and that's going to come here to St. Paul for you to redistribute in your wisdom around the state to our needs. I mean, as a city council person, when a project comes up, I say, where's the money going to come from? Are we going to get it? What's the good on this? So this bill is the closest we've ever come to completing this project. We are ecstatic about it, just ecstatic. I want to thank you for hearing this bill so quickly. Thanks to all in the committee who have worked forever on this. And thank you for coming last year to Mankato to hear more in-depth testimony when you were down there. This road is about safety. It's about economic development. We have a way to get it done. And we're just excited about it. Thank you to the committee. I'll answer any questions that you might have.
Thank you very much, Councilmember Foreman.
Thank you.
My last testifier that I'll call up is Patrick Baker from Greater Mankato Growth.
Welcome, Mr. Baker.
Good afternoon, members of the committee. My name is Patrick Baker. I have the pleasure of serving as the Vice President for Greater Mankato Growth, which is our Chamber of Commerce and Economic Development Organization serving Greater Mankato. I do want to thank Representative Brand for introducing this legislation, all his co-authors. I think Representative Torkelson's comment that this is a perfect storm this year is apt. There are many around this table and in this room that have played a leadership role in getting us to this point. Also want to make sure I thank MnDOT and the governor and their staff for getting creative and taking a leadership role on bringing this before you. The speakers before me talked about some of the safety aspects, some of the traffic aspects of this road. I just want to talk a little bit about the business case, right, for why it's critical to finally finish the last remaining 12 miles of this highway corridor. as you may have heard, Greater Mankato's economy is experiencing tremendous growth. I want to give you just a few highlights that are emblematic of that growing vitality of Greater Mankato, but also the entire Highway 14 corridor. Our region received its designation as a metropolitan statistical area in 2008, and currently has a population of just over 100,000, which is up 21% in just the last few years. Of the 32 metropolitan areas in all of the upper Midwest, Greater Mankato has the third highest growth in our gross domestic product and the fourth fastest growing personal income. Last year, Greater Mankato beat the state average in job growth. And in the last 3 years, $500 million has been invested in private projects in our metro area. From a transportation perspective, we continue to be a hub for travelers to our community for medical care at our regional hospital and clinic, education at our five colleges and universities that serve 26,000 students, including the second largest university in Minnesota, retail, where we're a level one regional trade center, suggesting that a great number of folks travel to and from our community for their shopping needs, and employment, with our daytime population increasing by 61% each day. And finally, those transportation logistics. As Councilman Foreman mentioned, we process more soybeans than anywhere in North America, and we serve as a distribution hub for several trucking firms, including a Walmart distribution center. And those stats aren't just unique to Mankato. They are reflected across New Ulm, Rochester, Owatonna, and many of our communities that are along Highway 14. So the key threat in all this is that we need our community to efficiently and safely move goods and individuals out of and into our market and across the entire region, and it's never been more important. The regional centers of New Ulm, Greater Mankato, Waseca, Owatonna, Rochester add economic diversity to our state and are poised for significant growth. By passing this important piece of legislation, you would give southern Minnesota the basic infrastructure it needs to realize its full economic potential. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Councilmember Rainey. Is there anyone else that in the audience that would want to briefly testify, either in support or opposition? Before I call on you for concluding comments, I just wanted to share some short reflections. You know, I've served on this committee continuously since 2003 when I first came here, and I think Representative Nelson has. He might have missed one biennium, but he's been here. We're the grizzled veterans, I think, on this committee, on, at least in transportation. And, you know, there hasn't been a year where this issue hasn't come up in one way or the other. And I remember several years ago someone came from the Highway 14 corridor, and they shared either it was a campaign lit piece or some kind of, and you remember, Representative Mason, or some kind of brochure from the 40s, I think. And so when you talked about history, Representative Torkelson, this really goes back. And so I think today we are really taking a giant step forward and, you know, completing a project that people have talked about literally for decades. So I'm very proud of the work that you've done, Representative Brand, and the commissioner and our members on the committee on a bipartisan basis. And it's good to have a day like this, and appreciate your work very much. So, Representative Brand, your final thoughts.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair. You know, Mayor Busman from New Ulm mentioned to me that back in 1999, the New Ulm Journal wrote an op-ed saying, "Why wait to 2020 to get Highway 14 done?" Well, if we look at your calendars, we're at 2020. And so they maybe had some forethought into the future about what was going to happen, but why do we wait till 2020? Well, there's a lot of projects, not just Highway 14. There's the Highway 12s of the world, the Highway 212s of the world, the I-90s. There's just a lot of roads across Minnesota that are also in need of assistance. And I just want to get to the point where I can open up the New Ulm Journal or the Mankato Free Press or turn it on KEYC News in my area of the world and see the story or read the story about Highway 14 being completed between New Ulm and Rochester. We're going to get there because of this legislation. I'm really happy to be a part of this process. I also think it's important to mention that the people that came before me in my position, I know you served with Clark Johnson, and he talked about Highway 14 in this committee. Same with Terry Morrow in this committee. Representative Ruth Johnson also talked about Highway 14, and this goes all the way back to 1989 in our district with Don Ostrom in being representative of Nicollet County as well at one point. And so representatives from Nicollet County have just been fighting for this, just like everybody else. Look at the room, we're full of partners. Highway 14 partnership is more broader than you think and you can anticipate. It also encompasses our former congressman, now Governor Walz. The Highway 14 issue was dear to him when he was a congressman at 1.2, and it's worth noting that. But I really look at this opportunity as just the stars aligned for us. To have this back in session off from 2010 as a pilot project that was just looked at as an opportunity for MnDOT to look for a new opportunity for funding and for us not to use it until now, but for us to rediscover the fact that that money is available or that access to money is available at the federal level. I'm really proud of the fact that we can work with our federal partners. I always look at that as a state representative. An opportunity for us to work with our federal partners is a good opportunity. This is a good opportunity. And last, I'll close with a little story. In 2018, when I was running for this position, I was just a city council member, and Highway 14 wasn't part of my city. I'm from St. Peter, and I served in St. Peter City Council for 7 years. But when I went to the Cortland Community Center that one day in the cold depths of February, when we were talking about Highway 14, it was a huge community conversation. There were maps all over these tables. Everybody from the community, every stakeholder from MnDOT District 7 and invited to the including community members, was there. And I'll never forget going to the table and looking at some schematics for a section of Highway 14, this very shovel-ready project we're talking about now. And I remember looking at a gentleman standing right next to me. And I looked at him and I said, "So what do you think of these plans? What do you think of this project?" And he looked at me and he said, "I'm a firefighter in Cortland, and I'm tired of pulling dead people from cars." Now that hit me like a ton of bricks. That has always stuck with me. I know that the fire chief knows who that was. I don't need to know his name. I just need to know his story. His story is the story of every person on that Cortland Fire Department. It's the story of everybody in the Nicollet Fire Department. It's everybody that has to deal with this stretch of highway and everybody across the state that has to go to other highways where the fatalities or serious injuries. That's the story that I carry to today, because I think that's the most important story I can tell. I'm really hopeful that we cannot have to continue to talk about the fatalities, but we can talk about the safety and the people's lives we allowed to go home, the families that were allowed to be home at night, to share that love and attention with those family members that made it home safely on Highway 14. So with that, thank you very much, committee members, and I really appreciate this opportunity today, Mr. Chair, to talk about House File 3977.
Thank you very much, Representative Brand. This is definitely an issue of statewide significance and importance, and I'm glad we can move on it today. And with that, I will renew my motion that House File 3977 be referred to the Capital Investment Committee.
Mr. Chair, first, don't we have an amendment?
We did.
Oh, wrong bill. But second, the other point that I wanted to make,
Representative Torkelson,
is why are we going to capital investment?
Mr. Lee?
Mr. Chair and members, originally some conversation with the Department of Transportation indicated that there might be an impact of the state debt management guideline. The MMB fiscal note that is in your packet on page 7 that was just released today notes that since the loan is considered a taxable obligation of the state and not backed by the full faith and credit of the state, it would not count towards the state debt management guidelines. So for context, any bill that impacts state debt management guidelines, such as appropriation bonds, general obligation bonds, has a referral to the Committee on Capital Investment. However, it's in the purview of members to decide what counts as a debt obligation to the state.
So, Representative Ferguson, we're just following that directive, but of course we can change that if you feel that it's.
Well, I'm not trying to run your committee for you, Mr. Chair. I just was curious. You know, we did hear 42 bills in the Capital Investment Committee last night after 6:30 p.m. And you know, we can hear one more. That's okay. But I just I'm just curious if it's really necessary. I the last thing I want to do is hold this bill up. I want it to move as quickly as possible, and get it moving because we all want to see this done.
Well, you know what? I clearly agree with you, and you know, maybe Representative Nelson, and then I want to hear if we can get some advice from the commissioner too.
Well, Mr. Chair, I was just going to say that if there's any chance that it has to go there, if we send it to the floor and then it gets mucked up and then we have to send it there, it's going to make it take longer. Mm-hmm. It would be probably prudent to send it there just to be safe so we can get it out of here.
Well, what I am wrestling with right now is whether we should send this to Ways and Means. And I guess, you know, the advantage of having Commissioner Kelleher here is she's also a former speaker, and I want to get her advice and her thoughts, because there is an argument to be made, Representative Torkelson, about that the committee, and I certainly would not. We have to fast track this,
yep,
and it could get really mired. It could be mired down. So I really appreciate your. You know, thoughts on this, and Commissioner.
So, Mr. Chair, humbly, I think that a referral to Ways and Means allows the Ways and Means Chair to re-refer a bill by, not anymore. So, Mr. Chair, I think I was looking for Ms. Hasmer. You want to, where?
It's a rules question.
Rules.
Mr. Chair, you could lay it over and have a consult with the Capital Investment Chair. I think it's really in her purview then whether, and the Speaker's office, whether they need to see this in that committee or whether it could go to Ways and Means as a check on the financial issues regarding the bill.
Mr. Chair.
I, Representative Nelson.
Back to what I said, if there's the chance, if we're going to hold it up by not sending it away or to the Capital Investment, the Bonding Committee, we should probably send it there and let the Chair Mary Murphy, Chair Murphy, make that choice and get it. If she can send it right out, then she can send it right away to Ways and Means. But if we send it to Ways and Means and it gets to the floor and it has to go back, it's going to take it longer. I think the faster track would be to cover our bases and send it there.
I've been consulting everybody except the author, and Representative Brand, do you have a thought on this?
I do. In anticipation for kind of mapping where this goes, I realize there'll probably be a couple of stops. I do see the wisdom in actually going to Capital Investment, getting that crossed off the list, going to Ways and Means, and then onto the floor. That's kind of my map. There might be an additional stop in there, maybe GovOps or something of that nature, but I hope not. I hope we can just get it done. So I'm fine with that, and I will be kindly asking the chair of the Bonding Commission, Capital Investment Committee, to hear the bill as soon as possible. The goal is to get this thing done as soon as possible so we can get that application process started.
And our original thought on this was in consultation with our nonpartisan staff, and. But it's always good to have a discussion. Representative O'Driscoll, last word.
Well, Mr. Chair, since you're taking advice, my experience with this would be that, and having been in government operations and seen things kind of flying through there as the chair in the past on that, I would suggest you stay with your designated bill route on this. Today it can be referred to and get in the possession of Capital Investment, which I think they may be meeting tomorrow for sure on Monday. And that can be moved out, and it can be in Ways and Means within a matter of a couple of days. I think Representative Nelson's advice is well taken. And so I would ask the chair to rule in favor of Representative Nelson.
Having heard from, I've always wanted to do this. Heard from Representatives Torkelson, O'Driscoll, Nelson, no, and Brand,
yep.
I will renew my motion that House File 3977 be referred to the Capital Investment Committee.
Okay.
All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye. All opposed, the motion prevails. Thank you very, very much. And
thank you.
I appreciated the fact that people wanted to move this quickly, but we want to stay within our lane here, as it were. Representative Schultz, I saw her. She's here. She's ready. Members, let's regroup here and welcome back to the committee. I think this is your second appearance this session. Our next bill is House File 3498, and I will move that House File 3498 be referred this time to the Ways and Means Committee. Welcome back.
Thank you. So this may be my first time this year to the committee.
Okay, well, I know you were here
last year. I think I was here twice.
Yeah, okay, good.
So
the years just get a little blurry, you know.
I understand, Chair Hornstein. So my bill is House File 3498. And what it does is address a problem in my district that has been a problem for many, many years. And I've got many parents concerned about the speed limit in school zones in Duluth. And I was surprised to find out that we don't, as a state, have a statutory school zone speed limit. And so this bill creates a speed zone limit of 20 miles per hour in urban residential districts. That's houses that are situated less than 100 feet apart. And for school districts or zones located outside an urban residential district, there's guidelines for setting a speed limit that's at least 10 miles, but no more than 30 miles below the existing speed limit. And then finally, the bill allows local authorities to establish school zone speed limits without doing a traffic and engineering study beforehand. And the effective date is August 1st, 2021, to allow local authorities for implementation time.
Okay.
And I think we have some testifiers, and then I can have, I have more comments, but I want to hear from the testifiers first.
Let's get the testifiers in. I have Nick Mason. Welcome to the committee, Mr. Mason. Please state your name for the record.
Thank you, Nick Mason. Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Nick Mason, again, with the Bicycle Alliance of Minnesota. And I'm here to testify today in support of this bill. On November 1st, 2019, Patrick Vitek, a Dakota Hills middle schooler, rode his bike to school on his birthday. He was killed when a motorist struck him just feet from his school campus off of Diffley Road. As an organization that has been invested in safe routes to school since its inception, we were devastated that such a horrific crash could occur literally right in front of a school. This is unacceptable in our state, and as Minnesotans, we need to stop letting tragedies on our streets like this happen over and over again. I have personally attended a number of community meetings and even helped lead local residents throughout a workshop to identify actions to improve safety. At every single meeting, parents and community members said the speed limit is too high on Diffley and other county roads that connect people to the destinations they need to get to. According to the U.S. Department of Transportation, people on foot and on bike are 80% likely to be killed at 40 miles per hour versus 90% likely to live at 20 miles per hour. And just for the record, the speed limit on Diffley, adjacent to an elementary, middle, and high school, and this is not a unique situation in the state of Minnesota, was 45 miles per hour at the time of the crash. This bill is a critical first step towards making it easier to reduce speeds on roads, especially where our children are walking and biking on a regular basis. Our current language around school speed zones allows different public entities to point fingers at each other instead of protecting our children. This bill remedies that critical safety gap. Bike MN also believes that safety-enhancing infrastructure like signage, flashing lights, bump outs, demonstration projects, and street reconstruction, especially road diets, that discourage higher speeds make the most difference when all working together. Making the choice to support this bill puts our priorities on the health and safety of people and not the throughput of vehicles. We cannot afford to lose any more kids on our streets, especially those near schools. For this reason, the Bicycle Alliance of Minnesota strongly supports House File 3498. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Mr. Mason. And I just wanted to say that I did have an opportunity to speak to the Bicycle Alliance of Minnesota gathering today. We have people from all over the state advocating for various bike and pedestrian safety issues. And I did go to a meeting in Eagan shortly after the tragedy that you described, and I was taken by the passion and the interest. I know Representative Mason is near there. I think it actually took place in Representative Halverson's district. But, you know, a grassroots group started there called the Eagan Pedestrian Alliance, and I'm seeing this all over the state now. A few days later, I was invited to a meeting in Representative Morrison's district. Same kinds of issues, school safety, speed limits, speeding traffic around kids. You know, I'm making this point now, Representative Schultz, because I think what you're proposing here is something that people are feeling acutely all across the state. And, you know, that really came into focus with the tragedy that you're describing. So thank you, Mr. Mason, for your testimony.
Thank you.
Our next testifier is Brian Sorensen from MnDOT.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair and members. First, I want to support some of the discussion that's already happened here, and I want to note that at MnDOT we are in full support of the intent and the spirit with which this legislation has been written. It is our job to make sure that students can walk and bike to school safely every day. We are in full support of that approach and doing whatever we need to do to make sure that that can happen moving forward. We are concerned with, there's two concerns I want to highlight with setting blanket speed limits like this. And one is that, as we know, without constant enforcement, not everybody follows the number that's on the sign. And so what that could mean in areas where we are signing a 20-mile-an-hour speed limit is we could get a large variation in speeds in what's happening in those school zones, which can present a challenge to anyone who's walking and biking and trying to cross those roadways and being able to judge appropriately when they can cross. And so there could be some increased safety risks created by a blanket school speed zone. Secondly, and I think has already been mentioned, we do need to address all the aspects of safety around our schools. So, you know, how school routes kind of interact with buses and vehicles that are dropping kids off and picking them up every day at schools, where the crossings are located. You know, those discussions should happen, and we're a little concerned about the perception that if we address the speed limit, then we don't need to address those other things. And so right now, the way the statute is written is that the local road authorities have the authority to set a school zone speed limit on the basis of a traffic investigation consistent with what's been set forward by the Commissioner of Transportation. And so there is guidance in the Manual on Uniform Traffic Control Devices that lays out that process and allows the stakeholders, the school, the community, the road authority to get together and talk about all the aspects of safety surrounding our schools. That all said, if we want to improve safety on our roadways and reduce the number of fatalities and serious injuries statewide in the coming years, we're going to need to continue to be open to new ideas. So I don't want our comments today to be misconstrued as what we're doing is just fine. We need to continue to be open moving forward, and there have been some new ideas and innovations implemented even just recently when we talk about rectangular rapid flashing beacons, hybrid pedestrian signals, and right now MnDOT's in the process of, and I think was mentioned by Mr. Mason, exploring the potential for demonstration projects that would make more significant changes to roadways that would actually induce drivers to reduce their speeds and ultimately contribute to safer roadways. And lastly, we want to mention that the state aid division within MnDOT is in the process of convening a task force for speed limits. And those committees that will be created are convening local and state stakeholders to study whether changes need to be made to state statutes and to the processes we currently use to set speed limits across the state. We would support allowing that process to play out before we make any further changes to statutes governing speed limits. So with that, I just want to note we appreciate Representative Schultz's efforts to enhance safety near schools, and we're ready to work with her and others on the issue of school zone safety moving forward. And with that, I'll stand for questions.
Thank you very much. Let's do this, members. I want to make sure that we get all the public testimony in. We do have the room. We have one more bill after this, and we do have the room for after session. So I just want to make sure we have a good discussion, and I don't want testifiers to have to come back. So is there anyone else in the audience that wishes to testify in favor or in opposition? And we can always call Mr. Mason back up if people have a specific question from anyone else on this bill from the public. Okay, so we have three members on the list now. Representative Schultz.
Yeah, I just want to make a few more comments. So in your packets, members, there should be a letter. And just within 3 days, I had one parent get over 75 signatures in support of reducing the speed limit for one school in my district, which is very dangerous because students have to cross Superior Street, which is almost like a highway. But the speed limit is 30 miles per hour, but people speed. So they want to reduce that speed limit to 20 miles per hour. And they wanted this for a long time to address the traffic situation and the high speed of the vehicles, but no one is doing anything. So there's a lot of finger pointing, like I think happened in Eagan as well. And so this, they feel, is one solution that they need to first establish a lower speed limit and then enforce it and then do other things. But the city of Duluth, they don't have the funds to put in the flashers and the pedestrian crossing. And I think that's true of a lot of local units of government. They just don't have the funding available to do all the curb bump outs and other ways to slow traffic. Also, I want to mention that I also handed out fatalities and injuries in Minnesota and nationwide, so you can see the increase that's been happening. And I predict more increases in fatalities and injuries from vehicle, pedestrian, and cycling crashes because people are still distracted while they're driving and not paying attention because of cell phones and GPS mapping devices. I did have a good discussion with the Department of Transportation, and I'm happy to know that there's a task force meeting, and I think it's been since 2008 they haven't really evaluated our speed limits in Minnesota, so it's time to do that. And I also want to note that we need to look at automated enforcement. So other countries use this very successfully. In Helsinki, Finland, and Oslo, Norway, they've had zero fatalities in the last year because they do a lot of more automated enforcement of their speed limits. And lastly, we need to increase the state aid street fund for municipalities at the state level so they can invest in ways to slow traffic, particularly around school zones.
Thank you, Representative Schultz. So our list right now is Representatives Elkins, Petersburg, Bernardi, and Hausman. Representative Elkins.
Yes. Thank you, Mr. Chair. A question from Mr. Mason. I met the gentleman, Brian, from
Sorensen. Mr. Sorensen.
Sorry about that.
Welcome back. Representative Elkins.
Thank you. So as committee members know, this is an area of the law that I'm know like the back of my hand, and I like to observe that I think a lot of the frustration around these kinds of issues gets back to subdivision 5A in here, in this case, speeding in a school zone. But the I'm just going to read the first sentence. Local authorities may establish a school speed limit within a school zone of public or non-public school upon basis of an engineering and traffic investigation as prescribed by the Commissioner of Transportation. So the frustration is that that's a black box. None of us know what those criteria are. But in general, I feel certainly that there's been an over use or over-reliance on the old 85 percentile rule. And so local governments don't ask for these studies anymore because if you have a street where there's existing speeding and you do that kind of a study, the study usually reveals that, oh, you should be raising the speed limit. And that's just not an acceptable outcome for any local government or neighborhood if you're trying to address the kinds of things that Representative Schultz is trying to address in this bill or what I was trying to address with the two bills that I got passed last year. And, you know, if there's going to be this kind of a study, it has to, you know, first of all, acknowledge that the 85th percentile rule has never been properly applied in many contexts, like a single lane a residential roadway. Those studies upon which that methodology was based were mostly on big, really busy four-lane roads, with the idea that you want all the cars traveling at as close to the same speed as possible to avoid, you know, weaving, cutting a lane, people cutting in and out of lanes. Situations that just don't occur on many roads where this methodology has been applied. So I think that if there's going to be a study, that has to be a study that recognizes the inapplicability of that methodology in many contexts. And a recognition that an example like a school zone, even if it's a four-lane road, a rigid application of that type of methodology is just not going to be acceptable.
Thank you. Do you have a question there, or just?
Well, I just want to know if those kinds of considerations would be or planned or anticipated or have already been voiced in terms of what the scope of this committee is going to be.
So the. If I could boil it down, the question would be what sorts of considerations related to Representative Elkins' question have you considered?
Yeah, Mr. Chair, Representative Elkins. So there's two things here. I think a lot of what you're talking about is the process that we use to set a posted speed on a roadway. Just to be clear, that process, an 85th percentile, really isn't much of a factor when we're talking school zone speed limits.
Okay.
Other factors come into account there in determining what that school zone speed limit should be currently, but we're not looking at the current speeds of the road necessarily to define what the school zone speed limit should be. So just to differentiate. That said, your comments about using that as a main factor for determining our posted speed limits statewide is something that this task force is going to review. And I can tell you is something that's being talked about nationwide. I had the opportunity to be at the Transportation Research Board annual meeting in January this year. This discussion is happening all over the world. Yep. And we heard from multiple countries across the world that are adjusting their methodology. So this is a discussion that's happening as we speak. And you know, ultimately the challenge here is we want to make sure that whatever we do, it's going to improve safety. And speed harmonization is a factor, and so if we create disparity in speed, it can increase the risk for crashes, and so that is a factor that we will consider. That said, I can tell you this group is going to talk in detail and openly about whether 85th percentile is the right methodology moving forward.
Thank you.
Okay, thank you. Representative Petersburg.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and this is for the department as well. Because I think everybody around this table, including you, that you mentioned, we are interested in the safety of our children and crossing. But I also share your concern that when you do a blanket change in speed, try to make it into a one-size-fits-all, that you also lead into issues. Obviously, the bill itself, a couple of different places, talks about reducing the speed 30 miles an hour. That's an abrupt change for that short school zone that may or may not be longer or shorter. So my question for you is, understanding all that and with the need for enhanced safety as well, and if this is unworkable because we want to have something that's more adjustable for each particular situation, what is the department's suggestion on how we review and actually enact safer zones for our children.
So, Mr. Chair and Representative, so this gets back a little bit to that traffic and engineering investigation, and we do have a process for that laid out in the manual on uniform traffic control devices, and it has to do with looking at hazards that exist, looking at factors that would play into the degree to which people are going to comply with a different speed limit. It has to do with, you know, where the students are present, how they're interacting with the road before and after school. You know, part of it is looking at, you know, what the school zone actually is. And so taking all those conditions into account in order to come up with something that, you know, the road authority, the school, the community can all buy into. And that gives us the best chance for compliance with school zone speed limit. But as, you know, as we talked about with Representative Schultz, I mean, we can change a number on a sign, but there's going to be a certain portion of the driving public that's just not going to follow, you know, that speed. So that consideration currently is part of the process when we're talking about, you know, what should we do to post a school zone speed limit during certain times of the day.
Mr. Chair?
Representative Petersburg.
Just a quick comment. You know, I just look at 30-mile-an-hour change in which somebody who was not maybe paying attention as well looks up and their brake light's on and they swerve to avoid somebody that's slowing down and there's a person in front of them walking across the road or something. I just think you need to establish some transitional period and so forth, and you can't just arbitrarily say what works for one community will work best for another. And so just a amount of caution there.
Chair, may I respond to that?
Yes, Representative Schultz.
Thank you, Chair. So this 15 to 30 miles per hour change is also existing in statute. And so the mandate that the bill requires only in urban areas that it goes to 20 miles per hour, and then it gives local authority flexibility in where they want to set it based on the speed limit, the current speed limit of a county road or a road with a higher speed limit, and that's the 15 to 30 miles per hour.
President Petersburg.
Mr. Chair, I don't want to debate the issue. The question is, though, is that it's done without any kind of investigation. It's arbitrarily given that it has to change down to 20 without consideration of how it might impact. That's a concern. Not that it's not already in statute, but in statute it's done with the investigation piece, which this eliminates.
And this is only in school zones when children are present, is that speed limit.
Thank you. We have Representatives Bernardi, Houseman, and Tabke, and another bill to get to after this. Representative Bernardi.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I didn't hear Mr. Mason's position at MnDOT. I wanted to understand.
It's Mr. Sorensen.
Oh, Mr. Sorensen. Oh, okay.
I'm
thought
sorry.
It was that,
Mason,
and I heard you
Mr.
say Mason.
Mr. Mason is with the bicycle.
Okay, I knew that, Nick. Okay, Mr. Sorensen.
I'm Brian Sorensen. I'm the state traffic engineer for the Department of Transportation.
Okay, thank you. So I have two questions. Who's going to make up that state aid division task force? Because I want to make sure that the public is a part of it and there's community engagement. It's not strictly one profession or one sector, you know, include public health and those things. And then my second question is, what is MnDOT and your department's commitment to ensure that context-sensitive solution policy stays in place as a standalone policy and continues to be implemented at MnDOT and not watered down?
Mr. Sorensen.
Okay, Mr. Chair and Representative. So to your first question, my understanding and, you know, my office is not leading this, so we are a participant, so I don't want to speak too much on behalf of state aid, but my understanding is state aid is creating two communities. One is a transportation user group, so it would be more kind of the general public made up of users. So some of those agencies I've been told are Metro Transit, Bicycle Alliance, they have a county public health, Minnesota Trucking Association, AAA Minneapolis, there will be law enforcement involved.
Okay.
So I, you know, to answer your question, there's not general public to my knowledge, but there is going to be input from outside users that are stakeholders in this process.
And that's good for
Representative Bernardi.
Yeah, that's good for that question. So thank you. And I appreciate that. And then the other one about context sensitive solution is you'd use the context of the environment to develop our road projects. And I've heard that it's not being as robustly supported, and it might be taken out of its own policy. And I want to know what role your department and MnDOT is doing to ensure that it continues on to support the planning of good roadways.
Yeah, Mr. Chair and Representative, I'm not aware of any change, and I do. So I've been at MnDOT for just a little over a year, mm-hmm. and there, what I perceive is that there is more willingness to consider context with our designs. And so, the feeling I'm getting is it's more a part of our day-to-day work than it ever has been. So if there are concerns with that, I guess I'd like to hear more about that.
Okay.
So that we can address them.
And Mr. Chair, I'll just follow up. I know that the policy is being reviewed right now and wondering if it should be morphed with other policies, so that I'm happy to hear that that's being practiced at the at your work, because that's super, super important. And I just really want to strongly encourage MnDOT to keep that policy as a standalone policy. So thank you.
Thank you. Representative Hausman, and then Tabke, and then we'll move towards the vote.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My question is for Mr. Burris. I'm trying to understand Section 3, and particularly 226-228. The school speed limit must be at least 10 miles per hour below and not more than 30 miles per hour below the otherwise established speed limit on the affected street or highway. And then 232-232. The school speed limit under this paragraph must not be less than 15 miles per hour and not be more than 30 miles per hour below the otherwise established speed limit. And so in one case, we're saying must be at least 10 miles, and the other one must not be less than 15 miles. There's probably a simple reason why it's drafted that way, but it's...
Mr. Burris.
Mr. Chair, Representative Hausman. So the overall structure of the language being changed, or the provisions being changed in the bill, is first to establish a 20 mile per hour default limit in the in the residential areas. And then outside the residential areas, and you see this is the language in paragraph A, there's a requirement of all the local units of government to establish a lowered school speed zone for school districts. And that's where the 10 to 30 miles per hour is set as what the lowered amount would be. And then paragraph B modifies the current authority that local units of government have to set a different speed limit. And that 15 to 30 range is it's a move of what's established in current law for under that authority. So the directive sets 10 to 30 mile per hour below the surrounding limit in those areas for the school zone. But then there's permissive authority for a local unit of government to instead establish a different amount within a slightly modified range of 15 to 30 miles per hour.
Representative Hausman, do you have any follow-up questions?
I guess then I'm confused. The lines on 3.6 to 3.8, which we take out, it's three different sets that all seem to say something different. We're taking one out and putting two. Anyway, I'll have to figure it out.
Okay. We have one more member question from Representative Tabke.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair. In the last few years, the Shakopee school districts, near Shakopee school districts, we have changed all of our signs over to when children are present. And I didn't see any language in here that allows us to still use when children are present. And then you said it just a little bit ago that is the way it is. So could you make sure that we're clear on that, Representative Schultz, and then I'll be fine.
I think we want to refer to Mr. Burris.
Yeah. Mr. Burris. We'll give him a minute. And I'll take this minute to remind folks that we are going to do the Real ID bill one way or the other today. And following this bill, we will at least get it started. I'm willing to have the committee sit 5-10 minutes extra if we need to. But we do have this room after session, so we want to make that announcement for those that weren't in the room. Representative Torkelson.
Just to fill a little more time here, this particular bill seems like it needs some work, Mr. Chair. There's a lot of questions. And just changing speed limits is not the only answer to school zone safety. The department has analysis of these situations is important. While I'm not going to vote against the safety of our children, I do have some serious reservations about this bill.
Okay.
Mr. Chair, so that language, to answer Representative Tapke's question, thank you, Chair, is on line 3.5, 3.6. So this defines a school speed limit when they go into effect. When children are present, going to or leaving school during opening or closing hours or during school recess periods.
Okay. Representative Tapke?
Yeah, that clearly answers my question. Thank you very much. So I'm good.
Mr. Burris, ready? Okay, he's as ready as he can be, I think.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, Representative Tapke, I was just looking at that same language. There's a kind of a technical question that I'm going to need to dig into a little bit more along those lines. But the when children are present piece is clearly in the statute. There might be a further question on the scope of that and whether it would apply just to trunk highways or to all school zone speed limits. So I'll have to check a little bit further on that piece of it.
Okay. Is there anyone else from the committee that would like to weigh in on this? Representative Schultz, there are some things that are there are some things that need to potentially be cleared up here. I can give you the option of we could lay this over if you feel that you can work on this. I know that Ways and Means tends to not want to do amendments or changes, but if you feel comfortable with, I feel like there's some clarity, but there are other outstanding questions. I'd sort of leave it up to you if you feel you're ready
sure.
to go.
I can talk to Representative Hausman offline. It was confusing to me too, so it took me a long time to understand, but I think it's written correctly to give flexibility to local authorities with or without an engineering study. But I just want to mention the fiscal note and just to let you know that one fatality is too many, especially when it's with a child. And so the more we delay doing what other states have done by implementing speed limit in school zones when children are present, the higher the likelihood is we'll see more fatalities and injuries that could have been prevented. And so the parents in my district are very frustrated, and I'm hoping that we can do something fairly quickly to reduce the speed limit and then enforce that reduced speed limit. But the fiscal note is there, and I would just encourage support for this bill, and if there are questions, I can answer those offline.
Representative O'Driscoll.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I do have also some concerns, not the spirit and intent. I certainly am not questioning that at all. But if you take a look at lines 2.23 through 2.28, a local authority must establish a speed zone. I'm just thinking in my district and others that I'm familiar with in central Minnesota, the school might reside in a community that has jurisdiction, but there's a county road that the school is on. Who is to establish that speed limit on the county road? Is it the county or is it the local municipality or township that school resides in? The other question I have is what happens if it's on a state highway? I can think of a couple of examples in central Minnesota where that's the case as well. The local authority, it's a state highway. I don't know if the local authority can trump the work of Department of Public Safety or MnDOT. And then the definition of public school versus non-public school. I think I know what a non-public school is, but I think others might have ideas of what a non-public school is. If I open up a learning center, or is it the school of dance or something like that, we might just need to kind of tighten down that definition, because a lot of folks who think that the speed limit is too high in their neighborhood may establish a private school to try to take advantage of reduced speed limits in their neighborhood on this as well. So just some things to consider, I think, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Any other discussion? Representative Elkin.
Yes, sir. My sense is also it might be a good idea to lay this over.
What changes would you propose?
Well, I have the same concern. In the bill, the section that says speed limits are in effect appears to only apply to trunk highways.
Representative Schultz, do you want to clarify that?
Yes, Chair. So if you look at it refers to as defined in subdivision 5A on line 2.8. So that's 20 miles per hour in residential urban areas. And then the speed zoning, which I think the language people are concerned about, takes away the need for an engineering and traffic investigation being required. And then the rest of the language is for or outside an urban residential district. So there's a speed limit in urban residential and outside urban residential, and the local authority would be the city if they own the road, or the county if it's a county road.
Representative Elkins.
I'm trying to read the existing language at the same time.
Members, I mean, we have a number of questions that I'm comfortable with this legislation. I'm comfortable with it moving forward. I think it is straightforward. I think there, members have asked some good questions. I think that Representative Schultz, I would advise that, things that you've heard the concerns, and this bill has been around now for almost a month, or at least a couple of weeks. We will have another opportunity again. While it's not ideal, but to make some corrections. I'm satisfied with this. I think we need to act on this issue this session, and so I would encourage members to continue this conversation. But I feel comfortable moving this bill today. Again, if people want to ask more questions and clarify things, that's why we have hearings. So, Representative Tappy.
Mr. Chair, I concur with your assessment that we can move forward this today.
Okay, is there any further discussion? Representative Schultz, do you want to just wrap this up?
Sure. I'm happy to answer all of those questions, and I think they have answers where we have definitions in statute already, the definition of schools, and clarifying the confusing language on the last page of the bill. I hope members can support it, and if you have other questions, we can follow up offline.
Okay. Well, with that, members, I will renew my motion that House File 3498 be referred to the Committee on Ways and Means. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. All those opposed, the motion prevails. So thank you, and thanks to everyone that weighed in. it's time. I would be willing to present this bill, and if folks want to kind of plow through till 2:30, maybe we could get it done. If not, we can come back. I don't want to rush this either. So. Okay. He knows about plow.
Different than putting the plow down.
All right, thank you very much, Mr. Chair. We're now going to take up House File 3964, bill concerning Real ID. And we're going to get as far as we can on this one in 15 minutes. So, Mr. Chair, please state your motion.
Thank you, Chair Tabke. I would move that House File 3964 be referred to the Ways and Means Committee. And members, this is a bill that really has its origins in a February 14th meeting of the VTRS committee. We heard a presentation from the Department of Public Safety, and quite frankly, both myself and I think I speak for Representative Torkelson and others on that committee, we were concerned that something like 11% of Minnesotans as of that time had received their real ID. The second area of concern, Mr. Chair and members, was that there was at least an eight-week turnaround time, which I understand may have gotten better, between when one applies for the real ID and then one receives it. The third area of concern that we learned at that committee was that there was confusion regarding the kinds of documents that folks needed to bring to the center where they would apply for real ID. And actually now I know that a number of very positive things have taken place since then. For example, kiosks have been set up at the airport. I think there's been some additional clarity given to deputy registrars and others. But what myself and Senator Newman, Representative Torkelson and others felt needed to happen first and foremost was, is there a way within federal law that we could change some of the documentation that's required? And so that's what House File 3964 does. And if there were additional resources that were needed to expedite this process, we would give those additional resources to the Department of Public Safety. And so we have a couple of amendments to get the bill in the shape that I would like to get it in, and perhaps those could be considered, and then we could have a discussion.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So you first have an A2 amendment?
Yeah, the A2 amendment is just some clarifying language related to high school identification cards. This was flagged to me by Senator Newman. I know we're not supposed to talk about the other body, but this is language that conforms with the Senate bill. You know, I've taken a look at it, and it seems fine with me to add this language in. It clarifies again the kinds of IDs that are available to us in terms of expediting this process. So that's the A2, and I'd like to have that considered first by the committee.
All right, Chair Hornstein moves the A2 amendment. Was there a question or comment?
Just comment, Mr. Chair. I would speak in favor of the A2 amendment.
Thank you very much, Representative Torkelson. Any other discussion? Seeing none, all those in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
Anyone opposed? The A2 amendment is passed. There's also an A3 amendment.
So A3 relates to an allocation. I didn't check ahead of time for DPS, but if you are available to come, that would be helpful. The A3 is an amendment that would help fund some additional staffing for temporary staffing to make sure that we can, again, further lower the backlog, further expedite the issuance of the real IDs. It provides money from another DVS account. It's not a general fund appropriation. It's using existing money. I guess I would ask maybe Mr. Lee to explain that pot of money, and then I would ask the Department of Public Safety to discuss what they would use that money for. And we have a small oral amendment that we want to do to this as well. But let's get this amendment on the table, and then we can consider it.
All right, Chair Hornstein moves the A3 amendment, and we have a couple of oral amendments to that. Mr. Lee.
Mr. Chair and members, in your packet there should be a fiscal note to the A3. There's two fiscal notes, one to the underlying bill and one that is labeled House File 3964 A3. The fiscal note shows a total cost of $2.7 million from the from the Vehicle Services Fund in order to cover the requirements of the A3 amendment. So essentially, the A3 amendment sets a goal for turnaround time for the department, and the fiscal note is the estimate of how much money it would take to accomplish that goal. If you turn to page 3 of the fiscal note, you can see the estimated additional FTEs necessary. And then on page 4, you can see the estimated costs with the total personnel costs at the top, one-time costs, and then equipment costs. And this would be split over two fiscal years. The amendment allows the spending in fiscal year 2020 and 2021. So in context, right now the Vehicle Services Fund has a balance in fiscal year 2020 of $7.6 million. They would like to have, the agency has a target for reserve of at least $5 million. So this would spend that, the vehicle services account, down to about $100,000 under the reserve policy, but there would still be about $4.9 million left in the vehicle services fund should the A2 amendment be adopted and the bill be enacted.
Thank you very much, Mr. Lee. And so, Mr. Chair, will you please restate the oral amendment for everyone to the A3?
There was an issue that was raised with us just recently with the Department of Public Safety, and I'm going to ask Mr. Burris to state the amendment. There was on the A3, you'll see on line 1.12, there's a fairly the language is fairly rigid in my original thinking on this about not more than 45 days. The department has raised some issues about that language that we want to amend, and I'll ask Mr. Burris to do that. Maybe proffer the oral amendment and maybe explain the background for it.
Mr. Burris.
Mr. Chair and members, so I have two pieces to the oral amendment, which would set the dollar amount as well as modify the turnaround time language. So the language of the oral amendment would be page 1, line 4, delete the blank, and insert $2,709,000. And that, again, is an amendment against the A3 amendment. The second piece of the oral amendment would be page 1, line 12, after must, insert make reasonable efforts to. So that, again, Mr. Chair, would set an amount of $2.7 million for the appropriation, as well as modify the language on achieving the turnaround time so that it's making reasonable efforts to achieve that 45-day turnaround time.
And
Mr. Chair,
I think that it would be incumbent on the department and, of course, for all of us to understand exactly why that we arrived at that number and what that appropriation would be used for, and most importantly, members, how it would expedite the issuance of real IDs, which is the goal of this bill.
State your name for the record. Representative Assistant Commissioner Timothy Leno, Department of Public Safety. Thank you for having me here. As of February, we have 700,000 of 4.7 million here in Minnesota with real ID compliant credentials. Between now and the end of this calendar year, we anticipate that up to 1.4 million may yet apply. So that would end up with 2.1 million compliant out of that 4.7 million here in Minnesota, or approximately 45% would be real. As a comparison, Wisconsin's a few years ahead of us. They're in the low to mid 50% saturation right now with real. So we're looking at some very significant numbers coming in, and we've made some predictions based on a number of different factors. Certainly we look at over the summer period, we always see an increase in the number of people that have to renew their driver's licenses. We also see an increase in what we see with people updating their home addresses in a national election year. But what we're seeing also in combination with that is the significant increase in those that are coming in for real compliant credentials. We anticipate that if we don't add additional resources, our ability to maintain the federal requirement, which is essentially two eyes. So right now, somebody brings in their credentials to a deputy registrar's office or a driver's license office. They present those credentials to that office staff. They look at them, input them into the system, and then according to the federal government, now we have to review them for a second time before we can push them through as approved for credential issuance. Our challenge right now is maintain sufficient staff in DVS that can take on that amount that we're expecting, and the number is significant as we start to move into those summer months.
Thank you, Mr. Lana. Representative Petersburg.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just briefly, that may sound low numbers, but do we have any idea of how many people already have other forms of real ID compliant information, or those that may have chosen not to, that they'll never use or need real ID? Because both of those are options, and because of people that may already have a passport or something, they may choose to wait till the regular renewal. Do we have any feeling about what those percentages might be?
Mr. Lana.
Mr. Chair, good question. One example might be passports. Here in Minnesota, we've determined with the help of the respective agency that we have about 37% of those here in Minnesota have passports. And you would expect that maybe those individuals would be less inclined to go back in and get real compliant credentials, since they would already be able to use those types of, but what we're seeing is almost 80% of those that have passports are actually coming in to get real compliant credentials. So to your point, it seems like people will continue to move the direction towards having real compliant credentials.
Thank you, Mr. Lana. All right, thank you. Mr. Chair, in light of time, and we have one other issue that has come before us that we'd like to get handled with Representative Brand's bill to make sure it's okay. Going in the right place. We've got some clarity around that. Are you okay with stopping this discussion
of
now?
Course.
Getting an A3 adopted, and then we'll come back and finish the rest of it.
Yeah, and thank you, Mr. Chair, and that would be my recommendation as well. We want to get things right, and the Highway 14 bill, the Real ID bill are very, very important, and if we need to take the time to get that done tonight, let's get it done tonight. So I support what you're trying to do here.
All right, thank you very much, Mr. Chair. So we have currently we are considering the oral amendment to A3, just so everyone is clear as to where we are. The two items in that oral amendment to A3 is on lines 1.4, adding replacing the blank with $2,709,000, and then on line 1.12, after the word must, insert make reasonable efforts to achieve a turnaround time. Is everyone clear on the oral amendment? Okay, all those in favor of the oral amendment?
Aye. Aye.
Anyone opposed? All right, that passes. Now we are moving to adopt the A3 amendment to get the bill in the format that the chair would like to see. Any further comments on that, Mr. Chair?
No, thank you. Ask for your support.
Thank you. We are now voting on the A3 amendment as amended. Thank you very much. All those in favor?
Aye. Aye.
Anyone opposed? The amendment as amended passes. There we go.
So do you want to do the issue with Representative Brand now?
Yes, please. Okay. We will come back after session to finish the Real ID, House File 3964. So we need a motion to table this, right?
No.
We can just lay this on the table. We don't need to do anything else. Okay. Very good. So, Representative Brand, we now have some clarity around 3977 and where this needs to go currently.
Mr. Chair?
Yes, Representative O'Driscoll.
Procedurally, you have to ask to reconsider the bill to bring this back before the committee when the time is appropriate.
I'm sorry, could you restate that? I missed what you're saying.
Sure, Mr. Chair. Because we've already taken action and passed this, you have to have a motion for the committee to reconsider that bill when it's appropriate, because I know time is of the essence on this, so I don't want us to have any procedural get-ups. Again, by government operations, Boy Scout training coming to hand again here.
I appreciate all the help. So does Representative O'Driscoll move to reconsider and reconsider the re-referral of House File 3977?
So moved, Mr. Chair.
Do we have a second? All right, do we only need a second? I'm going back to my mayor side. Yeah, I'm sorry. Yeah. We're going. all those in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
Anyone opposed? Passes. All right, thank you. And now we need, we make a motion to re-refer House File 3977.
As amended or no?
No. House File 3977 to the Committee on Ways and Means.
Correct?
Representative Brand, is that what? You need to have?
Yep, absolutely.
I
was just told it was not as amended.
Okay.
All right, any discussion on the item? All right, seeing none, all those in favor?
Aye.
Anyone opposed? All right, passes. Thank you very much. You are headed to Ways and Means.
All right, Mr. Chair, do you have, you want to take the final?
I think we're done.
Well, we're done for the moment.
Mr. Chair, I don't know if there's any further discussion on the real idea or if people want to come back. It sounds like we'll come back, Mr. Chair.
The bill is in the motion, in the chair. Where you would like. Representative Torkelson.
I do not see a need to come back. This bill is, I think, in the shape it needs to be to move on.
Okay.
I strongly support the effort. It's really two pieces here that are related to the same topic, but not necessarily interdependent. So we'll see what happens down the road. But making this process more available and easier for the public to get their real idea is something we should do as soon as possible, which would be now.
Well, I concur with Representative Torkelson, and if the committee wants to proceed now, I would support that.
Yeah. Okay, so we are taking back up House File 3964. So we have a recommendation to move forward with it right now. Does anyone have discussion or questions with regard to House File 3964? As amended. All right, so, Mr. Chair, will you renew your motion?
Yes, I renew my motion that the House File 3964 as amended be referred to the Ways and Means Committee.
All right, all those in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
Anyone opposed? Passed unanimously. Thank you very much, and we are now adjourned.
We did it, members. We did it.